pan down the galaxy in turmoil of the podcast. Here, the Gorsome Foursome join once again to talk about the Duel of Fates, Colin Trevorrow and Derek Connolly's script for episode 9 that will never be made. This week on the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast, a full breakdown of the script, all that, and oh so much more on the Droids. Welcome back to the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. Alongside the entire core group of droid heads, Ryan, Sam, and Chris, I am Mike. Thrilled to be back in person for a podcast that really might be the most monumental undertaking we've ever done here on this pod.
The biggest event in podcasting history. I have to say, we're all here in person, which is not always the case. I'm losing my voice a little bit, so we're going to have a little down-home podcast. I might get up, make some tea, get up, have a coughing
it's
fit.
It's an old country-style podcast.
You're seeing the strings.
You know, the old country-style podcast where you get up to make tea in the middle.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nice. I like when we do this. I like when we get to look in each other's eyes.
Go back to this.
I'm looking at each of your eyes. And we recorded...
Sam, keep both those eyes straight. You have one eye looking
at that. Well... In this pod, I think we're going to go through, and for those of you who have not read the script, Duel of Fates, which was the Episode 9, 2016, December of 2016 script that was leaked online. It has been all but confirmed that it is the actual real deal. Even the concept art is spot on. So if you go through the concept art that has been released, it's very clear that this is in line with what Colin Trevorrow and Derek Connolly wrote. They were signed on. We know how everything went from there. JJ brought in after Kathleen Kennedy and Lucasfilm made the decision to part ways. So we got Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, instead of this script. Now, for those of you who have not had a chance to read this script, we highly recommend taking the time. It's 130 pages. You could probably get through it in, what, 2 hours?
It's a good read. I think Chris had someone read it to him, and it took them...
Yeah. I had Colin Trevorrow already read it to
me. I thought you were doing one of those AARP services where they read things to you.
Yeah. We went on Cameo and we had Colin Trevorrow read
it. Actually, I just had the actors, all the Cameo actors read it to me, so we'll piece those all together and we'll put it out there.
So take the time. Again, if you want to email the droids, we'll let you know where you can find it and help you out there. If you want to find the script, you can email us droidspod@gmail.com and we'll be going through it and we'll be trying to give you a little bit of background. So you will know what's going on in the story, set up a little bit and go through the story beats, some of the great dialogue, some of maybe the misses. We'll tell you some of our favorite scenes, favorite lines, get into the whole thing. But before we start, of course, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, Droids Pod, the Droids Podcast on Facebook, email us, droidspod@gmail.com, YouTube, Droids Pod, and find us and rate us and review us on iTunes. We do this for you. We love talking about Star Wars and joining the conversation with all of you, so please download and subscribe and listen, rate, and review. But we've heard from Sam and Ryan on your basic takeaways, but real quickly before we jump into the script, I'd say each of us just go through maybe 2 minutes of what we thought over all of this and before we start to break it all down. And let's start with Chris, since we've heard a little bit from Ryan and Sam. I think maybe 3 weeks ago they gave a very vague breakdown since they'd read most of the script.
We weren't allowed to talk about it because Chris hadn't read it yet.
Spoiler free.
Yeah, and now we will, and this is a very good notice. If you do want to go in raw to reading the script, this is not the podcast you want to continue listening to. This is going to be
spoilers
for a movie that doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Yeah. And never will exist. Right.
But here's the thing. If you, like me, wanted to go in reading the script in a very pure way, you can do that.
I would encourage it because we'll get into it. Spoiler, I love it. And it's like, it's the thing you're going to get. So go into it. It's like, this is the way it's going to exist. This is the form.
It's a great piece of EU.
Yeah. I think, my initial reactions as the man was reading it, he was doing the different voices, for me.
Richard Attenborough.
Richard Attenborough. It was pretty cool. It was, when he did BB-8, it was great. I think just from the get-go, there's an energy and there's an excitement in the script that was just kind of missing from that opening montage that was in The Rise of Skywalker. There's the name of our band. there was just an energy that was missing from The Rise of Skywalker, and I think that that energy was captured here, like, immediately out of the gate. They started, like, mid-heist. I think that every character got justice in this, like, the work that they did in the previous movies, I think there were some payoffs. There are some things I didn't like, obviously. It's not going to be 100% what I want to see. I mean, and I also don't know what version of the script this was would have been. Like, it was, would they have rewritten this? Would they have done more to it? Would they have added scenes, deleted scenes? So we don't know that. We'll never know that. And I think overall, though, it was a very fun experience, especially, like you said, reading it raw, like, without really knowing anything other than, like, maybe a few spoilers here and there. But reading it really felt like a delight. It helped kind of satisfy that need for an episode 9 experience again, and I was really excited about it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Chris. And my perspective, this is hashtag my episode 9. I'd like to get that going.
My 9.
I will henceforth think of this as the way the Skywalker saga concluded. Now, that's not to say that this is a better script or better story than what we got from The Last Jedi. I do think that this was, as you said, a more propulsive story, more energetic, more fun. It added some to the lore. I don't think it expanded the lore the way The Last Jedi did, but I thought there was so many moments where this felt like an indelible moment that would have stayed with me for a long time because they were well written, well conceived, well executed within a script that set things up from the beginning. There was not a lot wasted in the script. It felt like they knew what they were doing and knew how they wanted to pay it off. Even little moments that we'll talk a little bit about ended up playing big dividends towards the end, even within the first 5 minutes of the story. Sure. And so that was really rewarding to witness that in contrast to what we got from The Rise of Skywalker. But the thing that I kind of took away from this was it felt much more like a conclusion to the sequel trilogy rather than a conclusion to 40 years of Star Wars. And actually, that's what I wanted. I wanted a conclusion to this story. I didn't need to feel like they paid off, you know, so much more of Luke and Han and Leia. I wanted to see these new characters that I've come to love be concluded. And I thought this movie did that in a much better fashion. There are issues, there's weaknesses, but I had a much more pleasant experience and felt like this didn't need to hit a marketing quota of please tell everyone that this is the ending of a 40-year story. And I thought that was really fitting and well done in this movie.
To me, the most interesting aspect of it is that it's the draft is dated as 2016. So that means it's before The Last Jedi was released. So like The Last Jedi, it was written before there was public reaction to the film that it was going to be proceeding. So it clearly was made without the knowledge that like Rey and Kylo would be this huge thing that people were super invested in. We'll get into this a little bit, but, you know, Rey and Poe are very put front and center. Mm-hmm. Her relationship with Kylo is still expanded upon because they're still kind of force timing, as they say. But it's not written with knowledge of, like, the internet's response to these things. Now, that could be for better or worse, depending on how you feel about Episode 9 or how you feel about Rey and Kylo. To me, I really, really like this script. I was more invested in Rey and Kylo's relationship than the script seems to be, but this script also probably hadn't seen The Last Jedi yet either. They knew they had probably read the script the way that Rian Johnson had for Force Awakens, but they hadn't seen the movie. So I imagine that there may have been adjustments made the way that Rian Johnson rewrote The Last Jedi after The Force Awakens came out to focus more on the existing characters because he had focused more on new characters that he had created. We don't know exactly what that draft may have looked like, but I think adjustments always would have been made due to public response, but maybe not as big adjustments as were made due to the public response to The Last Jedi, to the movie that we got, which just felt like this complete jumbled mess. So that's, it's really interesting reading it as an artifact of that, where it's like, oh, this is where like two storytellers or however many storytellers are involved, there's two people credited on the scripts, actually wanted to go with this story as opposed to where they think people wanted them to go.
Yeah, this I'm going back to something Mike said that I really felt, which was the idea that The Rise of Skywalker really seemed to be written towards this goal of Disney and the marketing team and how they wanted to sell the movie of this being a conclusion to a 40-year saga. Excuse me, and they tried to make this, they tried to shoehorn in the idea that this movie was the ninth movie in a single story, which really was kind of an unfair layup, because 7 and 8 didn't set it up that way. And in fact, 6 set it up, like, left us in a place where that story had been satisfactorily concluded. So there's so many reasons.
And
that
3 ended that way also. Like, 3 right. closed out its loop and then was and on to the next group.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so, we've talked about this, the idea that each trilogy could have and should have really represented more of, like, the story of that generation than what we got. But I liked this story so much better in terms of how much it would have changed. I think the dialogue itself, I think the lines themselves would have all been punched up almost across the board. I think there's a handful of really good lines, and I think you can see where, or I feel like I can see in reading the script, I can read the lines that Trevorrow and
Connolly,
that Trevorrow and Connolly loved. Mm-hmm. And you can see, like, oh, they loved this. They wanted it in here. And it works in most of those cases. I also think that there is some interesting... I wonder how much of the tweaking of the story would have been in response to The Last Jedi reaction, or how much of the tweaking just would have been to strengthen it. Because I think there's two sort of key points that I don't love. There's really just two things I don't love in this script. And then across the board, I think it's stronger and I kind of love it. And then the other thing that's the big outlier is that Carrie Fisher was a big part of this movie. Mm-hmm. I think more is being made of just how big a part she is in this movie than, like, in reading it, I think that was actually a soluble problem.
Yeah.
And they treat it like it was not. So...
It certainly wasn't the kind of problem where they'd have to throw everything out and start from scratch.
Right, right. My take is that I got really excited reading this. I really liked the story. I thought there was a lot of new ground in Star Wars. Not so much deepening of the myth or extension of, particularly like an extension of like the Force, although there is some of that on cinema that we haven't seen.
Yeah.
But there was a really, really interesting... I thought this was taking new steps in terms of the idea of Star Wars and like it being a wartime film in a way that Rogue One did.
Yeah.
Loved it. I think it's kind of a travesty that they threw this out.
There's a little bit of you could tell in the script too, just kind of his descriptions and notes. There's like a little bit of selling going on too with the, like, each scene.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He's very like, it's very like pointed to be like, hey, this is that thing you love, and like you said, like you could tell the lines that they're hyped up about because they're usually framed with like little quips and things like that throughout the script, which I thought were fun to read, but it's like ultimately those are just kind of selling the picture.
Well, and there's a lot of like what I would describe as like, I guess it's like get it on the page dialogue. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff where it's like, we know where the story's going, we know how the characters have to get there, and we know, I think I want, you know, Rose to be this way, or I think I want Finn to be that way.
Yeah.
And there's little lines that just, you know, it's inconsistent. It's uneven throughout in terms of the characterization from the actual dialogue. But again, that's the stuff that you can be rewriting and writing
up to
the moment
you're shooting.
You call action.
Yeah. Well, the performance.
And even after that.
Yeah, and they're even not after that.
But there is like plenty of like, clearly the two of them were like, there will be a better version of this.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And that's fine. I mean, everyone does that. It's like,
because story-wise,
sure,
I think it is so much more cohesive, so much clearer, and it really does give a satisfying... Mm-hmm. I found a very satisfying ending to this trilogy. Is it the movie I would have made? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have any of these ideas.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
I wouldn't have made the movie Rian Johnson made. It did feel like holistically like original. They went directions I would not have thought of.
Well, they went to some other parts of the lore, of the mythology that we haven't seen on screen before, that we've seen maybe in the small screen but not on the big screen, and talking about Mortis and talking about even some history of the dark side and the light and what that could mean. So there is more to it, but as you said, you know, you get tastes and tidbits of that, and this is a great story on its own. It doesn't do necessarily the opening of the world that Rian Johnson does, but it doesn't have to. I didn't think that's what we needed from this movie.
It does do a satisfying closing of some things that I thought. Also, I gotta say, perfect amount of Emperor in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh my god. It. Yeah. There, the the nods, I felt like this is the successful way
mm-hmm.
that you pay off the 40-year yeah. anniversary. Yeah. There are yeah. so yeah. many notes. There are so many lines that are callbacks, that are referential. And again, on the page, some of them are a little clunky. Some of them might be a bit of an eye roll.
Right.
But again, you have to remember, first of all, you've got some of the most charismatic stars in cinema delivering those lines.
Sure.
There's going to be another multiple passes of dialogue. Mm. And also, it just didn't feel like the whole concept was, let's do a 40-year clip show anniversary yeah. reunion. Let's not do season 11 of Friends on HBO.
Sure.
As Star Wars, this was yeah. actually like, let's close out this story. And
well, it was like things like, we have to go to the Jedi Temple. They go to Coruscant.
Exactly.
They're not going to the Jedi Temple and watching
yeah.
the holograms that we see in episode. it's like they're going to the Jedi yeah. Temple. It's dilapidated. Coruscant has kind of fallen into despair. Okay, so now we know how that did. Rey has a double lightsaber in this. She doesn't have Darth Maul's double lightsaber right. that yeah. someone yeah. handed to her.
Yeah,
so we know. It's like, cool. So those are things that exist in the world.
I did think it was weird, the scene when they were watching the Younglings videos, though. I was like, they don't need to show that again. That is in poor taste.
You using Coruscant as a setting, right. you do enough you to tip your I hat. Like you tip the cat. Over to what happened with the prequels.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily get into everything that happened in the prequels, which might be divisive to some people. Well, no matter what anybody thinks, Disney was reticent to do too much about the prequels because of whatever perceived issues there were from part of the fan base. But by setting something there and telling your own new story, that's not an issue. That's something mm-hmm. that only, again, yeah. connects yeah. it all.
Also, you have a huge fan base that spent a lot of time on Coruscant and the Clone
Wars. Yeah, and loved yeah. it. Yeah,
and
so,
loved it. So it's like such different contexts.
Yeah, I think there's like a fundamental misunderstanding of who their actual fan base was.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Also in like what a successful like call quote unquote callback yeah. is, as if we need it. But it was so literal in The Rise of Skywalker. It was like literally the same thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
I do wonder sometimes, like I don't know. Chris, like with statements like you made in terms of like misunderstanding who their actual audience is, the core audience, the thing that this, like what we got and the way the movie played out mm-hmm. actually like hits me is that I get worried, like, am I the one who doesn't understand
oh, sure.
what like the actual like core fan base is? Am I the one who's like lost touch? Because, you know, if Star Wars is, you know, broad populist entertainment that everybody saw and was amazed by, mm-hmm. but we are part of a weird community
subset.
That really,
yeah.
really dives in.
Yeah.
You know, am I misunderstanding sort of like what it is? Because
sure.
I know what I look for in Star Wars,
sure.
and clearly it seems aligned with what, you know, what Rian Johnson finds fascinating about Star Wars and what, you know, Irvin Kershner
sure.
found fascinating.
Yeah, but. Sure. For sure. Yeah. No, yeah. It's like a 50-50 split.
Right.
There's, yeah.
Well, I think if we, I kind of mentioned this on Twitter recently on the Droids Pod Twitter account, is that like if we had access to what the internal numbers are for Disney, I bet you they have it broken out in terms of what that subset is. The people like us who live and die with Star Wars, who spend all of our time talking about Star Wars, who are fascinated with all aspects of the lore of the story, it's probably a small enough number mm-hmm. that they're more concerned with the broad populace audience, because they know that they need to be making the $1 billion box office and they need to appeal to that. Mm-hmm. And I think so many of the decisions, and we're getting a little bit away here from Duel of Faith script,
sure.
so many of the decisions that went into making The Rise of Skywalker were about making this for everyone rather than making it for the diehard fans.
Sure.
Yeah,
yeah,
I think, I mean, I do think that's evident. Yeah. And I do think there was a miscalculation, because I do think we got kind of the worst of both worlds, because we've talked a lot about how, oh no, was Rise of Skywalker, was it pandering to like the sort of the worst of fandom, the people who said not my Luke, and there was plenty of reasons to think that. But I'm almost like, I don't know that the people who are all the way on that side of the spectrum like that movie any better than we did.
Right.
Maybe they liked it a little better.
Yeah.
But I don't think it succeeds there.
I think kind of my reference was just like, I think there was a misunderstanding of like, people actually love the prequels. People grew up with the prequels and they weren't like looking at that group, that like audience yet. They were still looking at the original 1977 Star Wars, some people call it A New Hope, audience. And I think like Disney was, they were honed in on that because they had JJ doing it. They were just focused on that, and they didn't realize that there's this whole like subsection of like, hey, young people love these prequels. They love the Clone Wars. You got to give them like a nod, and then
it's like the worst thing JJ's made, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Just I mean, I didn't watch season four of Felicity, and I didn't watch the time travel on that, but I get that that's supposed to be pretty bad. Anybody seen that?
I'd say Gone Fishing is not that great.
Also. Didn't make it. Also, though, actually, it is pretty. What's interesting though is like we've gotten so deep into like what Episode 9 actually has become that it's like in an ideal world, the movie shouldn't have to be pandering to anyone.
Yeah, right.
Someone should just make the movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, but it's like we're like, well, they had to pander to someone. You know, it's like because. That's what they presented us, which
yeah,
is like,
and
that sucks.
And well, because we acknowledge as fans who are like looped in, we're not just fans of the story and the movies anymore, but we're fans of the process, we're fans of the production, we're fans of the studio. This is the burden, the gift, and the curse of being like as into cinema as we all are. That it's like we. As we analyze these movies, we think about those things and we look at like the calculus of like what's this corporation who's making these things and financing them thinking.
Well, which is why Infinity War doesn't work for me, because I knew that there was 8 other films already planned and I knew that everyone dying at the end of that movie didn't mean anything. That was my But in that is almost me being nostalgic for being a kid and being thankful that we were all kids when Twitter didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't follow all of that info. So I could just go in blind. Anyway, I think we're getting into a lot of other things. Needless to say, we're 25 minutes into this podcast.
Yep.
We have not even gotten the script. This will not be a single episode about Duel of Fates. We're going to be doing at least 2 parts, maybe 3. Finally, Chris is getting the episode 9, 2, 3 parter
part
that he
one,
always
two,
wanted.
3, 4, 5, 6, baby. 6 you know, part.
Maybe we'll destroy the Falcon on the pod.
Yeah.
It could happen.
I have that 6-scale Lego in the back room, so... we'll get away to chunking at that.
We've got Harrison standing by to break it. But let's get into the actual script. We're going to go through and give you broad strokes on some of this and give you a little bit of an idea of where the stories go. There's kind of, 3 different main stories that are happening at one time. Almost different quests, different adventures that then come together. Most of them towards the end, but we will give a little bit of background, because if you haven't read the script but you want to hear this podcast, we'll let you know, so you know, not reacting to this like we've seen a movie or that everyone's seen the movie or read the script. Let's just jump in and get to the opening crawl, which
Mike set the table for us, would you?
I'm gonna set the table. You know what? Mm-hmm. I haven't read this aloud before, and usually, you know, it's a good idea to read something aloud so you know what you're doing and you don't stumble your way through it. But
do you want me to play the song real quick?
Yeah, you know, I want you to do it with your mouth.
Bum!
I got it. I didn't say a long time ago.
Oh, Chris. Sorry.
He also didn't say Lucasfilm Limited.
I also didn't say coming to a theater near you. Dog Wars.
Little Tingle, Lucasfilm Limited, 20th Century Fox. Oh, wait, that's gone now. We don't have
20th Century
Studios. Really abbreviated. Chris didn't commit. He bailed.
And then there's a note in the script that the music fades down earlier than usual.
Skips the first sustained note.
The iron grip of the First Order has spread to the farthest reaches of the galaxy. Only a few scattered planets remain unoccupied. Traitorous acts are punished by death. Determined to suffocate a growing unrest, Supreme Leader Kylo Ren has silenced all communication between neighboring systems. Led by General Leia Organa, the Resistance has planned a secret mission to prevent their annihilation and forge a path to freedom. Pan down. A rich tapestry of stars.
Does it really say that?
No. I know. I wish. It says exterior space.
It will be a pan.
I wish. It was panned down. And here's where the first thing that I actually really liked about this script. We've seen a lot of different things to start after the crawl. I love that we would be potentially being brought into a docking bay and things start to surround us on the edges. I thought that was a cool way to do it at the beginning. For those, this is essentially, we see, as we're looking at the stars, elements of the kind of like enclosure of a docking bay come to the sides and you find yourself pulled into the docking bay of a ship.
Much like the Millennium Falcon is in Star Wars, some people call it A New Hope.
But can we also just, yeah. I mean, I don't want to run past the actual crawl.
No, yeah, I don't want to at all. But yeah.
Because I'm very excited to get into this, the actual movie. I love this opening like sequence that kicks off the movie in a much more dynamic and exciting way.
Wait,
than...
light speed jumping isn't dynamic?
Light speed skipping.
Skipping.
No,
oh.
Get it right.
You know I stand for light speed skipping.
But what I think is really exciting about this is this movie picks up, obviously, right after where Episode 8 left us, The Last Jedi, where it was, you know, the resistance had dwindled to the fewest numbers it had ever been. And what the stage that this sets is really interesting because it is truly how totalitarian regimes, you know, consolidate power. They are isolating groups of people from one another. They're thinning out their own power structures. You know, we learn that Kylo Ren has, you know, held the mantle supreme leader. But it's set up as the ways in which he is leading the First Order, at least in the crawl, is what we get. And then, you know, we are set up for the idea that the lack of communication is going to be the key in this movie. That is laid out from the crawl. The fact that people aren't talking and the resistance
It's such a good callback. A communications breakup can only mean one thing. Honestly, it is a callback.
It's that, but it also, I think, it does what I know a lot of people out there like to say, keep your politics out of my Star Wars, but it does the thing that you know, the best Star Wars movies do, and it addresses a real political issue, which is that, like, that's unclear information, the inability to spread truth is, like, a thing that strong men, you know, leaders do. And it's so exciting that, like, the mission of this movie is that General Leia Organa is like, we need to bring hope back to this galaxy and freedom by getting communications.
Well, and also as a storytelling mechanic, it puts our characters in the dark and it puts us in the dark. Rather than there's been a broadcast, the dead speak, and we all, somehow Palpatine's back. And our characters know what's happening. They know there's a countdown. They know what's going on. We're all kind of confused about...
It's like they read the crawl.
Yeah.
How close do you think the crawl for Rise of Skywalker was to saying, one fortnight ago, there was a broadcast.
There's a download code at the end of it.
You saw in Fortnite Season 2,
oh my God.
The dead speak.
I think that's just something that was really appealing to me, though, to the idea that we don't know where our characters stand. They don't know. We're in the dark as well, and it sets us up to be a little bit more unprepared for what could happen in the story, which was really appealing to me. And then we get to the fact that there is going to be an entire MacGuffin for our characters that leads to solving this issue. Like, the crawl does its job in telling us what's going to be part of the story.
Yeah, it also sets up the world as opposed to setting up plot points, which is exactly what The Rise of Skywalker was trying to set up plot points that we hadn't seen, where this is just like, man, stuff sucks. Kylo Ren's in a bad way. Moving on.
Yep. All right. I think we move on from there to really our first main sequence here. And Sam, being that this is something that you really gravitated towards, I love the start of this as well. But, like, if you want to take us through this opening sequence, which is really kind of focused on the first thing we hear, the first character we hear from, Rose Tico.
It's so gratifying. This is when I fell in love with the script in so far as I have, because it actually pays off on, you know, Rose being an instrumental character, a really, really colorful and well-developed character from The Last Jedi, and she starts.
Should we set the scene? Just like, we're on Kuwait, we're on the orbital ring.
Yeah.
Just to give it a little context.
It's the orbital ring of Kuwait, and you kind of are opening on, you don't know it immediately, but a clandestine mission. All the resistance characters we know, Finn, Poe, and Rose, along with BB-8 in a, like, spray paint disguise.
Such a great detail.
Are infiltrating this sort of stronghold where there's a strong, I was going to say Imperial, but I guess First Order presence. And they're on a mission. They're on a secret mission. To is it to blow up the ring or to blow up like
to blow
the
up
shaft?
The ring with yeah, all the power the energy shaft. That goes up to all of what
this
12 or 20
this
ships
reminds
that are up
me
there?
Of Star Trek when they have
oh, yeah.
the, like the big mining laser thing
yeah.
that hits
oh,
yeah
sure.
it, that's the kind of imagery that resonated in my
yeah,
head
yeah
they should have got whoever made that movie.
I wish we could find that guy honestly.
What happened?
That movie's great.
That man is dead.
Oh, no.
The Supreme Leader's dead.
And we get a great reveal of our heroes going through. It's like they're going through a checkpoint, basically, mm-hmm. where they're not to have weapons. But we, you know, everybody's kind of hooded and cloaked. We get through the whole mission kind of quickly goes belly up. Nothing's going to plan. We get a great reveal of Rey, who is also there, and we don't know it for a long time, but she is revealed, you know, fully cloaked, dark clothing, and she has a dual-bladed lightsaber, which Mike already mentioned.
She built it.
And it kind of ramps up and escalates. Sorry, I'm missing some of the details, but it ramps up and escalates to, like, a thrilling sort of escape
mm-hmm.
via
well,
stealing...
Star Destroyer.
Right? So call the Eclipse.
So
no, it's a Dreadnought.
It's
actually
a Dreadnought.
It's a Dreadnought.
So this concept...
Those things are fleet killers.
This concept was the original opening for Force Awakens, was Rey hijacking... Or not Rey, but a group of rebels hijacking a Star Destroyer.
Oh.
So this is like a concept that they've tried to push a lot. That's why you see in The Force Awakens the downed Star Destroyer. That was going to be how we met Rey, is that they hijacked it, junk traders pulled it down to the ground, and then
you mean that wasn't originally conceived of as the end of Battlefront 2?
No. No.
I think it's interesting, talk about like quote unquote callbacks, but without being callbacks, Rey appears in this similarly to the way Luke appears in Return of the Jedi, which is like, she has clearly undergone some training, has evolved to the next step. We didn't need to see that. We need to see her floating with rocks and stuff.
Yeah,
like, she just shows up with a dual lightsaber. She's wearing black, the universal code for they're a Jedi now.
Or the universal code for they're torn between the light and the dark, which is always sort of what I saw of Luke in Return of the Jedi. Yet, like, he's a Jedi now, but he's dressing closer to what Vader was.
Yeah, for me, it's a universal code for I had a salty lunch, and I feel self-conscious about my body.
They definitely lean, I mean, this script, as we go through it, this leans much further than I think Return of the Jedi did, or maybe was allowed to, you know, for whatever reason, Lucas decided not to take Luke this far
mm-hmm.
to the sort of like edge of kind of despair and darkness,
yeah.
where, you know, Rey is, this is a darker Rey. This is a version of Rey we haven't seen. And it's not dark, like, Sith dream Rey.
Right.
Like, she's not a villain. She is just, she's a hard ass. You know, she's someone who's going through war. She's militant. And she is seeing, like, the effects of war, the effects of all the losses, all the, like, humanity stripped away is impacting her.
They did keep the scene, though, where she files her teeth down to make them all sharp.
That was weird.
But she's still insecure about her place in all of it. She's insecure about her ability to be the person that everyone wants her to be, which is a thing that's interesting just story-wise, but also interesting as to whether or not that could lead her to a potential path of darkness.
I think
because she can't find what she wants to be.
Yeah, I think it's good heightening from the Luke that we saw. It's like, what would this look like extrapolated with somebody that's far more powerful? Like, how would they feel?
Whoa, more powerful than Luke Skywalker?
Sorry.
I don't know.
I love Rey so much. JJ really did her dirty on this one.
Yeah, he did.
Because this is so much better than what she got.
I don't think any character was made better in The Rise of Skywalker than they'd previously been shown to
be. Well, Claude.
Maybe I'm trying to think, the only one I could think of would be like Kylo Ren or Ben
mm-hmm.
having like the way The Rise of Skywalker handles his redemption arc, which I think the movie itself is clumsy around it, but
it's
like Adam Driver,
to say arc.
Adam Driver like does such a good job with everything, but like truly everyone else I look at and I'm like, it really kind of, you know, takes a dump on their character, you know?
You know what? I don't think that John Boyega agrees. Even though Finn does backtracking track almost entirely.
He loses anything interesting about
him. He does,
him.
But John Boyega was all about that. He was so, and everybody was
John
so
Boyega's
excited about putting
22 years old,
putting
or whatever. Like, he doesn't know what he's excited to be in a movie that's making a lot of money. He's excited to be like
also,
seeing his
their
career
experience,
on the rise.
Their experience, the actor's experience making the movie is so different from our experience.
Well, it is.
Just,
yeah, but he also he you know if you're gonna if he's so happy as a guy who's just being part of this franchise, why dump on The Last Jedi then before he started this one? Anyway, side conversation.
Moving on.
I want to get into just real quickly this in the first page of the actual script after the crawl, there's something that is set up that is paid off towards the end of the story, which is BB-8 weaving through to get to a, do they call it a scomp port?
Establishing a scomp link connection.
Which I've never heard of that before. It's more of just like they go to the port.
It's
but
a droid. It's a droid pluggy.
It's
a little spinny thing.
Do we know it's called a scomp?
I believe it has.
All right, scomp. Well, we're learning something new.
Maybe that was Legends, but now it's canon.
But
my God, Mike, you might want to cut this out.
Oh, no, I know. It's almost like I mixed up the hand that Luke loses.
Oh, wow.
Talk about setting up things on page one that pay off again. My first episode on.
I just love that it comes back. That comes back. Yeah. There is another scene with BB-8, now not in disguise, but we get later in the script where this is a moment that we know he can accomplish because he's done it before. Just part of a reference for the first line of this movie, it's BB-8, you in from Rose, which then goes back to what you were saying. Rey has done training. Rey has become a different version, has developed in the time since we last saw her. That line and then this entire scene and the time where Rose has spent time on the planet of Quat with the local...
with Claude.
Yeah.
Claude on
Quat. There's such great color there, too.
Yeah. The planet is mentioned in like legacy Star Wars books and things like that as well. It's like a shipyard planet, so it was highly contested during the Galactic Wars.
I'm curious what everybody was picturing, because I was getting very much, I was like, and maybe it's just what I've been like consuming lately, but I was getting a Blade Runner-esque vibe of just like, you know, a city under, like kind of under itself. And like,
see, I was thinking of Star Trek. Oh, there you go. Chris has got the image ready.
Phone to us while we're on mic.
But like, wouldn't it be cool on screen to see something in Star Wars we haven't seen, like an orbital ring above a shipyard planet rather than... This planet's really dark.
right.
Yeah.
Man, it's so dark on this planet.
Yeah.
Unless there's blue lightning, then you could see Star Destroyers.
Yeah.
But clearly, Rose is heightened, and there's more to
her. But what about
the
desert planet?
Well, and that's actually, oddly, just because I think it was in my mind, I was envisioning Pasana is essentially what I thought of for this sequence.
Oh, interesting.
And I thought of the same. I know. It's just, it was it was in my brain from the last time. It doesn't mean that that's the way it should be.
No, I was picturing this sort of like tent city, the very like 80s, like there might be a barrel fire.
Sure.
I don't know.
Yeah.
some kind of Star Wars-y barrel fire, an engine fire, something that people are
keeping
warm.
Laser fire.
Yeah. You know, it sounds like food is very, you know, is a commodity.
Some sebaceous crumbs on a spit.
But so we're dropped right into this action, and it reminded me a little bit of even what we've seen in other JJ films, where you just begin the story halfway through something that's already happening.
In media res, as they say.
Oh, okay.
In media res. That's the film 101.
I told you I'd use my degree, Dad. All right, page two.
We are on page two, 40 minutes into this podcast. I don't want to get into every bit of dialogue, but I know that we're going to talk about dialogue throughout this and things that worked and things that didn't work. And I just want to set up an early scene here where we know everybody's in disguise. Finn is in a robed kind of costume. He runs into someone, and this Drovian shoves Finn, and he says, "Whoa, no trouble here." And then the Drovian grabs him by the neck, picks him up, and Finn goes, "Trouble, trouble." Mm-hmm. And that, in my mind, felt very much in line with some of the scripts of what we've seen so far in the sequel trilogy. That, in performance, is obviously going to be a big part of how that actually is pulled off. But the tone felt right to me, and I'm curious if that tone was on point for the rest of you.
Yeah, that hit like a Larry Kasdan.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it felt
exactly.
That kind of swashbuckler, they're in for the adventure, kind of like, I know what I'm doing, and then that
a
that
confident person in over their head is like a very, it is inherently funny.
Yeah. That's a very good way
to describe it. It's Indiana Jones, it's Han Solo, it's other Harrison Ford characters than, you know, characters that Harrison Ford hasn't even played. It's, you know, they know what they're doing until they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, well, agreed.
So we've kind of given the gist to here. Obviously, they escape with the Eclipse, which is the Star Dreadnought.
The only two notes, like plot wise, that I think are really relevant is we do get a really crisp view of like Rey is really struggling with the hero's mantle.
Yeah,
she is. You know, in order to keep the Resistance and her friends alive, she has to escape with them, and in escaping, she has to leave the people of this planet to fight and face the consequences of their, meaning the Resistance's, actions. And that really weighs heavily. And Rey has a moment of realization that it's kind of the I can't save everyone moment. This is too hard. I wish I could stay and fight with them. But it's like either she would be lost, captured, or what good does it do? There's a bigger picture. Yeah. And that really kind of torments her. The other plot point is that they get aboard this Dreadnought and actually like storm the bridge and like figure out a way to fly it. I can fly anything, you know, comes back here in a great, you know, sort of callback. They narrowly escape on the jump to light speed, but they have a full Dreadnought with a full complement of kind of artillery and weaponry, and then a few captured First Order, you know, soldiers or pilots or whatever, you know, bridge crew, basically.
You set up a little bit too. Rey has such concern for everybody there, doesn't want to leave. This script and this movie would have done such a better job of showing us who in the galaxy they're fighting for, which is not what we got in the episode 9 that we actually saw. We didn't know what was at stake until the very end when it's like, all right, we've got Wicket there again and let's all cheer.
It's part of the issue with one of the strengths of we mentioned, we were talking about the, you know, the like the Marvel movies and the way like the Avengers movies had set up, and one of the negative things I think about like the Infinity War and Endgame Avengers movies, which I love, is that the cast of like heroes and important people in the universe has gotten so broad that they lose what Whedon did so well, which was to always remember to focus a little bit on the little guy, remind us who they're saving,
the waitress at the cafe. Well,
that's why you open Endgame with Hawkeye's family. And then you're like, yeah.
Right? No, it's a very hand wavy thing, and you get one or two people, but that's it. And the same thing, Mike. This is what you're saying. This is the same comparison of like the Trevorrow script has several points at which we see the people of the galaxy, the people who will show up in ships, you know, or whatever that's supposed to be a big payoff in Rise of Skywalker, but that we never met.
Yeah. It's Coruscant, which we'll get to. It's these migrants on Quat. It's also merchant that we meet on Bonadon later, which you see how Rey's affecting them, their hope through her, and that continues to be this undercurrent throughout the movie, which is really beneficial to the story. So I think from there, you know, there's little bits. I think I want to call out there is a moment, and I'm failing to find it in the script. Finn has a flashback to another stormtrooper that he was trained with, that he was conditioned with. And that happens during this whole sequence, and it sets him up for his arc in this film, which is an arc that I wanted, which we've talked about before, which is what was set up in The Force Awakens about the fact there could be other stormtroopers. And we get it with Janna in episode 9. And I think, you know, we're maybe leaning a little bit too much in these comparisons and we maybe shouldn't, but there is so much more of an emphasis on there might be others like Finn, and Finn could be someone to help them realize that and change their direction. And this film pays that off in this script. And I think I like that there's this little touch at the beginning that, again, it makes it all feel like it's earned in the story rather than just come out of nowhere. Oh, we ran into somebody.
It's also picking up where The Last Jedi left off as opposed to like...
Oh yeah!
No,
in
this
so many
isn't
ways.
What are you doing?
Yeah,
or don't like, play with my toys.
Yeah, or like, oh, like, let's make sure Daisy and John have a lot of scenes together because they're so good on Fallon together. Like, it's like,
the arc that you're describing, Mike, I think pays off Finn's character in a big way over the trilogy, over this film, and in particular in one of the handful of lines that I think really, really lands.
Yeah,
that we'll get
you're taking, that's like a classic. Like it is Spartacus, right? Like you're taking Finn, who was once captured by all these people, and he's rising up, and then he's leading an army against these people. Like, it's great.
It feels so funny to think about The Force Awakens, where at one point we were just kind of like, what do they do with Finn now? Like, I mean, what's it? It kind of, he didn't seem to have the next step. And obviously that was the job of the scriptwriter, but I felt like in that movie, it almost felt like he was floating in the wind. Then we get a better story in Last Jedi, and this would have paid it off.
It's also, a lot of that has to do with like our expectation that like if someone, an audience's expectation that if someone has a moment of being like fine, that means that their character now is totally fine and has no conflict. You know, it's like the thing that happened where the person broke down, they broke down like the mathematics of why The Last Jedi wasn't fair to Luke. And because at the end of Return of the Jedi, he had made the decision not to turn to the dark side, so why would we ever believe? And then Rian Johnson's response was like, that was a moment in his life, but people deal with struggles forever. So for it to be a thing where it's like at the end of The Force Awakens or the end of The Last Jedi that Finn now had completed his any kind of trauma that he has or anything is this kind of, it is archetypal storytelling, and it's a little simplified, and people may expect that from Star Wars because the originals kind of had that, you know, archetypal way of dealing with things, but these movies have gone to great lengths to deepen that.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think that the way that they deal with Finn in this script makes complete sense, that it was like, let's like really dive in here.
Yep. Well, and I don't think anybody,
it's not like harrowing, it's just, you know,
I don't think The Last Jedi like left anybody where, you know, you're feeling like, yep, all these characters are resolved because they came together and they got out of that scrape on Crate.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's still, but you also, that's part of the responsibility of making one of these movies, is that you have to end it in a place with some element of hope and some element of a win, you know?
Yeah.
A Crate scrape is red.
That's true. If you get a scrape on Crate, coming up red.
One thing that you didn't mention when you were talking about the stealing of the dreadnought, I think as we kind of try to get out of this opening sequence, there's so much to talk about. It comes back again later in the film, but something we haven't seen before is a powerful enough Jedi, or at least there have been powerful enough Jedis who could do this, but to watch Rey use the Jedi mind trick on an entire group of people, which was the First Order officers of the dreadnought, to pilot the dreadnought for them.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there's still one pilot pose flying anything, but they needed everybody at their stations.
And this is, I took issue with, because I've
never seen Luke do that.
So
why should she do that?
I think that this also, like, just talk about setting up a payoff. Like, this is the first time we see her, like, using, like, light force powers in interesting new ways, but there's the same things we know, but she does a really good job. Like, this is one of, I think, three or four times where she does mind tricks.
Yeah.
And one of them is pretty cool coming.
Chris, I'm just going to interrupt you because I think you might be embarrassed later when you realize that Luke actually hasn't done this.
No.
So, like, I don't understand, though. Like, if he's dead, how does she do it?
Which, you know, somebody actually was probably saying that within Disney, because why didn't they make this script?
That don't know that I'm kidding. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Of course.
I'm just kidding. Our listeners are smarter than that.
So we finish this entire moment. We see the eclipse leave. The dreadnought is gone. And who should also now come into our story but the Knights of Ren? The Knights of Ren in this film, this script, I love a lot more. I don't know. I mean, love is a strong word, but they're much more well-utilized.
Yeah, give me
Ever since I saw them in that one shot in that movie once, I knew, man, they got to be a big part of my life.
They finally,
my tattoo is paying off.
They do something interesting with them in this movie, which is that they serve them up as, you know, this script keeps Kylo Ren and Rey separated until the end of the film for a final confrontation, because this movie recognizes that the actual interesting direction to take this story is like, what happens if the generation after the greatest generation goes bad?
Well,
what happens if
would that be like?
What happens if the son of you know, the son of the heroes of the galaxy, you know, doesn't choose the right path, and it saves that till the end, so that our hero of this trilogy has her catharsis in that scene. And what you do with the Knights of Ren is they provide conflict in advance of that in the best way.
Well, I was going to say, as a plot mechanic, that's awesome. It's like Dementors or Ringwraiths in Lord of the Rings. Like it's
yeah.
They're never, no one is ever allowed to settle down because there's always this constant like bubble threat below them that's going to be rising up. So I think as a plot device, like it's what a like useful tool that is to have in a movie because it's like you can't sit down.
Well, you introduce them in this script. The way they do it is that within a moment they've killed the most powerful admiral that we've seen so far in the movie, Hatsaka Ren. Kills with a dark saber the admiral who's been leading the entire First Order that we've seen so far, not Hux, but at least in this film.
And I love the nod to the dark saber, which is like the weapon that was used to like kind of defend yourselves from the Jedi.
Exactly.
And is that what got this movie not made? Were they like,
we're gonna use the dark saber for Mandalorian?
In Mandalorian, we
Trevorrow
was
like, it could be something else. They're like, no.
It's got
you put so much work into it. We don't want you to compromise your vision. We're just gonna get JJ.
It was crazy that the prop they used for it though fit perfectly with the line of the Death Star. Still, so.
But that simple action just tells us everything we need to know about them. I also like that it seems like they play a little bit more into the fact that these might have been former pupils of Luke, who were at the overall. We're at the same training facility now. You know, we're doing this whole home down home version. Everybody's distracting me because there's a little message on the computer. It's not an important one, guys.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I
know if you want me to update Microsoft Word, I'll do that. But we can.
I'm just saying it's counting down in big red.
Yeah.
But the training facility that Luke had set up, we always had heard that Kylo left with several other pupils of Luke. And within this, the Knights of Ren not only have the dark saber, but they use the Force, and they use the Force to continue their chase of Rey.
You also need some, like, by the end of a trilogy, you need some level 2 villains.
Yeah. You know, like, well, I mean, Hux just isn't doing it. I mean, though, I love Hux.
They do something interesting with him, too.
In terms of, like, physical threat, though, like Chris said with the Ringwraiths, it's like, you know, we know that our heroes can dispatch of, you know, innumerable orcs.
Yeah.
But like stormtroopers, like we need.
Yeah. Can they take down a Ringwraith?
Yeah,
we don't
need
know.
The people that they show up and they go, uh-oh.
Yeah, exactly. Like, get them to question their confidence a little bit. That's like how you see them overcome things.
They also do something rather than just make this film does separate them. The Knights of Ren actually aren't with Kylo Ren at all in this movie.
Yeah.
And what they are is they're described later by members of the First Order as zealots and like. Essentially, like they're like the hard edge, like far, you know, far gone people, like in their beliefs, in following Kylo Ren and his order. And they also have their own personalities. They have their own characters. They have their own links. Two of them share like almost like a hive mind.
That was rad.
It's just like interesting. It's interesting things. It's small. They don't go so far as to make like. I would say full characters out of them because they know we don't need to be that interested, but they do more than just have them look like a death metal band.
They're enough to be threatening.
And then the
twins thing is like very odd and it's like, oh God, like they're up to something here.
We've never seen
that's
it.
Weird. Yeah.
We've never seen it before. It's almost like those two are kind of like, I don't know, what would you call it? Like a force dyad.
Well,
something.
It reminds me of that. The twins from G.I. Joe where they can feel each other's pain. Do you know this? So in the G.I. Joe cartoon, there's two twins, and they could basically, like, when one got punched, the other one felt it.
Oh, interesting.
So I would imagine that pulling out of that well of nostalgia, I'm sure that had an influence.
I was thinking of the precogs.
I guarantee you Trevorrow was a G.I. Joe guy.
I was thinking of the precogs.
Yeah.
Murder.
Red ball. We got a red ball coming in.
Remember when that guy leaves in that movie because he wants to go have cake? They have a red ball coming in and Tom Cruise is like, there's some cake upstairs, and he's like, I'm gonna go get some myself. And they leave the murder ball.
I don't remember that. No. But that's funny.
You know what? All my precog heads out there are gonna know.
They already knew you were going to say that.
Well, we'll get to more of the Knights of Ren because as they said, there's a little bit of that story continuing. I do want to mention just before we get to it, there's that moment where you're talking about there's this. One of the Knights of Ren is in a like back to chamber and trying to regain their health.
Right.
And the other puts their hand against the chamber and says, show me, or like, tell me what you see so that they can, through precognition, figure out where.
Was that your read that he was healing? I was under the impression that that's kind of how he exists.
Well,
that could be
this
too.
This is an interesting thing too of like, we talked about ways in which this reminds us of various like Star Trek elements, mm-hmm. but like this was a thing on Star Trek Discovery. The engine that they use, they call it a spore drive, and it's like powered by these like spores of a certain fungus. And they travel along the mycelial network. Really cool.
Yeah.
But what they figure out at some point is like they need a guide, and so that's the role that Anthony Rapp plays. He's like the chief science officer who figures it out.
He does it by singing, right?
And he should. That would have been great. Yeah. But like he essentially like. When they're ready to make a jump, it's like he becomes over the course of the season, like weirdly, like almost a computer brain of like knowing too coordinates much. Through this mycelium network. He goes into a container and he's like, activate the drive. And then he mentally like guides them. And it obviously this is different, but it instantly reminded me of that. Yeah. And I was like, I
that's
like cool. that.
That's I look forward to you getting more in depth on that on Star Trek Trek.
Thanks for reminding me.
Subscribe now.
Oh boy. Listen to all both of them.
Well, I think we could take a moment here after this opening sequence to kind of set up the where episode the story two. Goes. Yes, to set up episode two. As we're closing in on an hour here, I want to say that let's at least talk about what the main trajectories, the main arcs of our characters, how people are put together. Because this is not a story that is about this trio that we've never seen before getting their moment in the sun, and finally they're all together. This is a logical place to put them. With the exception of what you talked about, Ryan, is that you get the sense that there was a little bit of a difference of reading the script of what happened between Kylo and Rey of The Last Jedi and seeing the movie, because this is the pairing up of Poe. Poe is Poe and Rey. That's the love connection in this movie, which I don't mind. I think I probably felt the same way, too, that it's a little bit stronger with what we saw.
Yeah, I kind of, when I started reading it, I was like, oh, weird. But then as I got into the script, I was like, well, they like do a fine job with it.
Yeah,
they, I don't necessarily think there needed to be a romantic thing, but like...
Yeah, they motivated it. Like, at first I was off board. I was like, all right, whatever. And then by the end, I was like, I guess they are like sharing this experience together.
Yeah.
And they're like both kind of the leaders of their own experiences.
And I also tried to think of it just like with the movies as we're given them.
Yeah.
As opposed to this kind of like, we all of us went off on like flights of fancy of like Rey and Kylo, because that was such an engaging part of Last Jedi that it was like, this is the most interesting thing. But I was trying to think like, okay, if the idea of them being romantic together hadn't even been like a thing that had entered into the zeitgeist, or if it was like the first thing we see is that their relationship is continued in a different way in this movie, how quickly you could accept that it's like, okay, that's not the direction they're going.
Yeah.
This is one of the two things in the script that I actively didn't like. I'm fine with them being like, in terms of the way they branch off characters,
sure.
I'm fine with them being on a mission together. I think for a couple reasons. One, I do think it's an interesting thing to put like Oscar Isaac and Daisy Ridley and like let them have some actual like scenes.
The brain candy of the two of them together.
But I've never seen them do carpool karaoke together, so I don't get it.
I was interested in that. I also think more than that, I was interested in like the other pairings and like who that meant got to go with who.
Yeah.
And so I was like, great, that's perfect.
Yep.
This to me was like probably the easiest fix, where I was like, they will be smart enough over the months before this movie goes into production that they'll just remove the flirtation and just have it be a buddy move. Like,
sure.
You'll show their friendship build.
Sure.
And that to me was, I would have actually been, it would have bothered me if it got shot the way it was, where there is a romantic interest between these two characters. I don't think it's like interesting or motivated or does anything good.
I'm going to disagree with that in the way that I think my favorite moment of this entire script is between the two of them that they build to in their last moment that has more weight because of the romance that they've set up in this story. I consider it, and I don't know, I mean, we're kind of like dancing around the issue because we want to talk about it later in the script when we get into it. I don't know if we want to just address some of these things now.
Sure.
Let's set up everybody first.
Arcs. So the first arc is Rey.
Rey, Poe, and Chewbacca are off on an arc to find the destination that is a vision that Rey has had, where she will come together with Kylo Ren on the planet of Mortis.
RPC.
And they need to find a way to get there. Poe, and I don't recall, knows somehow some sort of force soothsayer.
He kind of does a classic, like, I think I know someone.
I know a guy at spice trading.
A navigator who's force sensitive, who was used by, like, spice runners or spice traders, you know, to map routes.
This is the
person who I actually think, who I think will help us. So they go on that arc that's ultimately Rey trying to confront Kylo Ren. That's that mission. Then we have
Rose
Finn,
and Finn back together again.
And BB-8,
with 3PO, BB-8, with the droids.
Oh, yeah.
3PO, BB-8, and R2-D2.
The droids you're looking for.
And they're on a mission to try and basically jumpstart an ancient, communication network that was used by the Jedi that's based ultimately on Coruscant.
Yeah, it's in the Jedi Temple. It's beneath
the Jedi Temple.
Another analogy to Lord of the Rings.
Which, what is interesting is, again, it is literally, it's like they're journeying into Mordor.
To light the torches.
Yeah, this is the most dangerous point in the galaxy. This is a consolidation of Imperial First Order power.
Also, there's an interesting dramatic tension that Chris has talked about before, where they're going somewhere that we know that they don't. So we don't know how Coruscant is going to be, but they're going into the Jedi Temple, which is a place that we're very familiar with.
Yeah.
But they are not, and that's interesting.
Yeah, because we know the corridors, we know the rooms, like we
know
the
library.
Yeah, we know the library.
There's no need like the way they did in the Rise of Skywalker, where now everyone knows who Palpatine is. The Sith magic thing.
Yeah,
with the it's like no, they're going into a place they've heard of, the Jedi Temple. It's on Coruscant. So we have this knowledge when they get to Coruscant later and it's like dilapidated.
Yeah.
We have a knowledge that it's like, man, this place is really fallen.
Poor
I didn't piece together that that's what the Jedi Temple was. I was just picturing
to be fair,
a Jedi Temple.
To
like,
be fair,
what is
that's completely understandable because it took me, I'd say, a good 10 years to realize that the Jedi Temple and Coruscant were the same place.
Right.
Yeah.
It also doesn't matter, like, both reading, your reading would, kind of enrich and give you a better viewing experience of, like, that anticipation, and my reading was just like, I don't know, I know what the Jedi are, I know they had a temple, I know what Coruscant is, which is really, really interesting to go back there, because the movie also sets up Coruscant prior to that arc,
where we see
what they're about to go into and why this is...
I would have been given that fun moment, though, where they said, like, it's under the Jedi Temple, and I'd go,
Right.
My favorite part, though, when Finn's like, I heard they got the best sandwiches at this little diner in Coruscant.
But we do get a nice setup of Coruscant a little bit before that, and talking again about people that are a part of the galaxy that matter, that want the hope, that look to the light of the Jedi, look to Rey. Coruscant has a member that we'll talk a little bit more about named Dade, and we get that early on in the story that sets up the world of Coruscant's going to be part of this. So then when the path leads Rose and Finn off to Coruscant, we know what we're headed for, and it calls back to what we already know about the place. So that is our two. Our third is the journey of Kylo Ren, and Kylo Ren's journey again starts on Mustafar, similar to what we found out was the Rise of Skywalker.
It looks like Mustafar, and it's
clear that it is Mustafar. They tell you, not just after the fact in some piece of visual dictionary, you find out that he's at Mustafar, and there's a reason behind that in the storytelling, and his journey to Mortis, and eventually his confrontation with Rey.
Also, he gets like real Frankenstein.
And he's ultimately, his arc, what I find really interesting is it is a continuation, again, of what we've seen in the first two movies. This character is on, he is so wounded by the expectation, he's so wounded by the failed relationship with each of his parents, that he is on a quest for ultimate power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because you juxtapose his story with the story of General Hux, who's, you know, kind of his his CEO running the First Order while he's away on this quest for massive power. And you see the two false brothers that were set up under Snoke, both on their own journey to like be the number one in the galaxy. Mm-hmm. That's what each of them is. Now, Hux seems to view that in a competitive, you know, the younger brother sort of way. And Kylo Ren doesn't seem to care. He wants ultimate power in the galaxy.
I also found it interesting that talking about they were making this free of like reactions to The Last Jedi.
Right.
I was reading it being like, oh, clearly they thought that at the end of The Last Jedi, when the door of the Falcon closes and Kylo shudders, that like that was him, like that was his commitment to like, because he's a bad guy in this movie. He's not like, yeah, he's like conflicted, but he's a bad guy. And they were like, clearly, like this is the end of his journey of being conflicted, and like he is now being like, right, he's leaning into this path of evil that, right, is ultimately, yeah, his destruction, because it is hurting, well, him and hurting, yeah, him and hurting him. And I was like, well, that's interesting. I can, yeah, accept that beyond the fact that I'm like, but I just like love Adam Driver's, yeah, face so much. And I just want to see him. Like,
well,
that,
it's
where it's like,
yeah,
yeah, like it is conceivable that a read of that scene in The Last Jedi is like, that's him being cut off from, yep, like the life that he, I mean, may have. Like redemption is now not in the cards for him.
Yeah.
He was already given the chance. Well, and like, yeah, now he is headed toward a self-destructive,
well, I
path
think,
of evil.
I think it does what a lot of good writing does, is like it backs them into a corner. So if they double down on that, then you're like, how could he possibly be redeemed? Or like, yeah, how can he, like the same way Vader was in the original trilogy. It's like, how could this guy possibly do something good or like change his mind or whatever? Like, I think it heightens that again. I think,
sure,
you just see another example of them like heightening the scenario of like, all right, if he's this far gone, is there a chance we can bring him back?
Yeah,
we don't know until
and
the
like
end.
I'm okay, although I would like to see redemption for Kylo Ren.
Yeah,
I am okay with it. With some, I can accept if someone's like, no.
I also
feel,
sorry,
like he got a little redemption in this.
He did.
Yeah.
I agree. I also don't think that there's much ambiguity in what Rian Johnson did in The Last Jedi.
Sure.
You're talking about, oh, it's clear that maybe he read that shutter as like, you know, this is the point,
yeah,
this is the decision. And I'm like, I think the decision is in that throne room. And I think the perhaps best element, the best moment of The Last Jedi is that rug pull of, because it worked on me. The sequence in the throne room worked on me so well. I didn't know if one of those two people was going to change sides.
Sure.
And I,
yeah,
thought one of them might, and I was desperate to see it, whichever it was,
right,
because,
yeah,
it was fascinating and it was, yeah, compelling. And when they both are like hurt and deal with that hurt in different ways that,
right,
neither will switch, it's like, oh my God, like, what a bold step, because all of us thought this had to be a redemption arc for Kylo,
right,
Ren, and they have now made him the supreme leader. He's the most violent, evil.
Right.
He's a bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the just cowardice of the Rise of Skywalker to shy away from
that. Even Luke and Leia are like, you know,
he's lost,
yeah,
now.
He's gone.
He's
like,
lost,
he,
to,
says,
us.
Did you come, well, here to save my soul? And he goes, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's,
yeah,
so great. It's
because,
and I don't, so I guess I'm just saying, it's unambiguous.
Yeah.
You
the
know?
Throne room,
yeah,
scene is like that last moment, because I'm realizing it now as you're saying it. What's interesting is that he's offering Rey a lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
He's,
right,
saying, like, lead this with me. It's either, like, I'm,
yeah,
going to go do my thing, or, like,
yeah,
come with me.
Well,
and it's an act of hope on her part where she's like, I may lose and he rules the galaxy as an evil, or I can have a guaranteed, like, I can keep him in check kind of deal.
Right.
Where he's like, come join me and we'll, like, do our own thing.
Yeah, it's,
and,
still... sorry.
But it is, like... It's just a good acting in that scene. He's desperate. He's like, please, like, I have, like,
right,
one... I could at least have one foot in.
That line is probably my favorite line of the entire sequel trilogy, when he says, please.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that
it's,
performance.
It's amazing. And, yeah, he's saying, like, I could have one foot in good and one foot in bad.
Right.
Mm. That's basically,
well, that's
what my choices are now. And then she says, like, no.
Yeah.
And then he has,
well, that's
two
the,
feet
the
in bad.
Thing there is, like, it's him, like... going on to do his own other thing. So he's,
yeah,
like, he's, it's greater than the First Order. It's like this,
yeah,
these are just stepping stones. And like that, I think that internal motivation is what makes him like quote unquote a bad guy.
You'll see. Well, you'll all see.
That's what makes him quote unquote a bad guy, because it's like, oh, he's doing this. He's not part of this group of people who want to like rule the galaxy for financial gain. Like he goes into this next level of like the Force has taken him so much.
Well, so we've been over an hour now, and we've...
Well, this is the setup. Now we'll really be...
We've set up the arcs. This is where things are going in this script. We're going to come back with our second episode. You'll get that next week. So this is part one of Duel of Fates, the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. Join us again as we continue to talk about the script from Colin Trevorrow and Derek Connolly. I got to say, this is some of our prime work that we've had on the pod. This is some of, this is a great conversation. Can't wait to keep
this
it going.
This is a great cut of meat.
This is
dry age. At least
age.
90 days, which
dry
is about
age.
How long it's taken us to all get in the same room together.
This is a warm glass of blue milk.
Join us next week for part two, Duel Fates.
Annie?
You know, I heard that blue milk, they use vitamin, a different kind of vitamin D. It's your magnesium.
Blue milk.